Minnesotan storyteller Kevin Kling is known for telling stories that are weird and wonderful. He makes audiences laugh until they cry, and he makes them cry until they laugh again. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, storyteller, actor, poet, and playwright Kevin Kling. He'll be spending next week as an artist in residence at Central College in Pella, culminating in a performance of his latest show, Breaking Hearts and Taking Names, on Saturday the 22nd. This hour, we'll talk about his life, telling stories, sharing his craft with others, and his latest book, On Stage with Kevin Kling. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is storyteller, actor, poet, and playwright Kevin Kling. And if you have ever heard Kevin Kling tell a story, you're probably getting pretty excited right now. If you have never heard Kevin Kling tell a story, then you are in for a treat this hour. He will be spending next week as an artist in residence at Central College in Pella, and that will culminate in a performance of his latest show, Breaking Hearts and Taking Names, on Saturday the 22nd. Kevin Kling, hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A lot of us became familiar with your work through commentaries broadcast on All Things Considered. You were on a lot in the late 90s, and I know for a lot of us, we heard those stories. We tried to tell our friends about those stories. We probably put on some Minnesotan accents to try to convey how funny and charming they were, and probably really didn't get it across very well. But for people...
Oh, I bet you did.
For people who aren't familiar with your work, I would love to start the hour with one of those stories. And I was so delighted to see the full story in your latest book, On Stage with Kevin Kling. And that's a story about painting the house. And that was one of the first stories I ever heard you tell on All Things Considered.
Oh,
I think.
Yeah. Yep.
Could you share it with us?
Oh, of course. It happened. I moved up to Minnesota when I was 4 or 5 years old from Missouri. And we moved into this rental house. My dad had a saying, he'd say, boys, never work on a rental, he'd tell my brother and I. So the grass was growing long and paint chipping off the house. And finally the neighbors were saying, you really got to mow that yard. And instead of getting a lawnmower, my dad went out and got a tetherball pole and put a cement can on the bottom and buried it. And all the neighbor kids came over and we packed the yard down. And when the yard got long somewhere else, whoop, up went the can and over somewhere else. So... he really had his own systems. And when finally they were saying, the neighbors were, you really got to paint that house. And it was looking bad. And so my dad says, okay, boys, we're going to paint the house. And we're like, oh, man, we want to play. And he's, oh, I understand, boys. We're going to get it done in one day. And my dad said he had a plan. And he gave my brother a wire brush. And he said, Stephen, I want you to knock off all the loose dirt and paint. He says, Kev, take this newspaper and tape and tape up all the windows. Get them all taped up. And then... my dad went and rented a compressor, an air sprayer, and he says, see, boys, it's going back tonight. That baby's going home, so we're doing it in one day. So my we go, oh, great, Dad. One day he said, what color are we painting the house? And my dad says, boys, I don't know. See, my dad was a manufacturer's representative, and he sold paints and pipes around the state, and he'd sold some paint to a water tower in northern Minnesota, and they'd had some extra, and so they'd shipped it back. And Dad didn't remember what color that water tower had been, but that's the color our house was going to be. So we go out to the garage, and he pops open a 5-gallon pail. He goes, ooh, well, boys, looks like we're painting her black. Okay with us. It's still one day. So my brother's off with the wire brush, knocking off the loose dirt and paint. I come by with the newspaper and tape, and I tape up all the windows. My dad comes by with that compressor and paints the whole house. I mean, by noon, we were done. And my dad says, okay, boys, we still got that compressor another half a day. What do you say we do the trim? Okay, Dad, what color are we going to do the trim? Well, I don't know. So we go out to the garage, and he pops open another can. He says, yeah, well, looks like we're doing it orange. So we did all the trim in blaze orange over flat black. And before we're even done, the neighbors are calling, saying, that's primer, right? You're painting over that. That's primer. And my dad says, no. In fact, this paint was a special graffiti-proof paint that they used on water towers for when kids would climb up and write their names. It was designed so when it rains, the rains would just wash off the paint. And that's the so that's what we painted the house. So the next people to buy it and paint it, as soon as it rains, right on the lawn. So that's the painting the house story.
And
I guess and there's a part that I don't ever get to tell. It's a years just about a year ago. Somebody says I got good news and bad news. They said they tore that house down. They finally tore down your old house. And I said, oh man. I said, what's the good news? And he goes, it was orange and black when they tore it down.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so nobody was ever able to paint over that.
You tell a lot of stories about your childhood, about your brother, about your sister, about your dad and your mom. When did you start telling stories?
You know, I think I always did, but it wasn't really brought to my attention. I think a storyteller... somebody has to tell you you're a storyteller. And I was at a party in Minneapolis, and in the kitchen, of course, where all good things and parties usually happen. And I was in the kitchen just babbling away, telling, you know, story after story. And I didn't know it, but there was a theater producer in there, and she, after the party, said, do you want to do that on stage? And I said, what? And she goes, just do what you did in that kitchen. And she put me in her next season, and after that, I never looked back. It's... I've kind of made a career out of it.
Once you figured out you were a storyteller and started thinking about how that developed, were there other storytellers in your family that you learned from?
Yeah, it turns out my whole family, my brother, I tell you, he can tell you how he put his garage door on and you'll be laughing your head off. And and as much as my family like to tell stories, they love to laugh. And I think that's just as important. And any storyteller worth their weight knows a good story is really a conversation. And my family loved to hear stories as much as they loved to tell them. And I think that's one of the things. A really good storyteller is a really good listener. They really have a passion for what makes a story work. And that was really alive in my family. And then when I went to college, I lucked out. I hung out with a bunch of guys and... pretty much your night before was only as good as your ability to tell about it. So it was. I was with some really good talkers.
What was it like that first time you got up on stage and told stories?
Oh, I was terrified. You know, and I still get nervous before every show. I'll be nervous before every time I ever go up. But once the stories start, and it even happened the first night, once the first two words come out, then I'm as happy as can be. I remember reading years ago that Carl Wallenda, the famous wire walker, said he was only alive when he was on the wire. And a lot of times when I'm telling a story, it's a heightened sense of life that it really is when I feel my most alive.
How do you read the audience? You talk about telling a good story is really having a conversation. It's different when you're telling a story in a kitchen than when you're telling a story on a stage.
It really is. And after enough years, I a lot of times if I'm in a really an unknown situation, if I'm in the Midwest, I can just pretty much go from zero because I'm really with a familiar group. But if I'm in, say, New York or another country, I have this little system, and it's kind of based on football coaches, how they'll have a few plays in the beginning of the game that they'll run automatically just to see what the other team is like. And I'll have a few stories that I have that by the response of the audience, I'll know what kind of evening I'm in for. And so I have five or six stories that I, in unknown situations I'll start with, and by the response I'll know what kind of audience I have and know which direction to go.
So you can just change your program depending on how you think the audience will react?
You know, the more, like the best storytellers in the country are all in their 80s and 90s. I mean, it's one field that as you age you actually really get a lot better at. And I noticed that most storytellers as they age usually go in not having a clue as to what they're telling, but they have hundreds of stories in their heads. And they'll see what the situation is, what happened that day, who's in the audience, and from that information know what stories to tell, which stories are the best for these people in this at this time.
when that theater producer at that party asked you to tell stories on stage, what were you preparing yourself to do with your life?
I was in theater at the time, and I was loving it, and I still do. I still write plays for, I'm working on one right now for the Children's Theater in Minneapolis, and I still love the theater, and I love that side of performance. And so that's kind of what I was hoping to do. But with storytelling, I got to be everybody. I got to be the director, the writer, the performer, and I really loved having all those roles and getting to play. If I wrote seven characters, I got to be all of them.
A lot of people who go into acting have described how, even if they may be shy in everyday life, when they get up on stage and they're wearing a costume and they take on another persona, it's a completely different experience. But when you're telling stories up there on stage, that's you. That's Kevin Kling. That's an incredibly vulnerable position to be in.
You know, it is and it isn't. It's still the persona that I care to deliver. It's one of the beauties of, you know, when you travel and you go to a different country, you can present whoever you want to present as yourself. And it's very similar to that. I get to present the person, and granted, it is me, but it's the aspects of myself that I choose to perform. But you know what? You brought up something. I can't believe you brought this up because nobody knows. You really surprised me with this. I think most actors really are shy. And when you said that, and people say, how can they be shy? They get up there and they put themselves out on the line like that. But you know what? When you're really shy, if you know what's going to happen for the next 2 hours, it is such a peace of mind. And when you're on stage, it's one of the safest places you can be. And it's like dancers. I've noticed that some of the most clumsy people I know are dancers. Like they'll hit a curb and they'll be right on their nose. And it's because they're used to these completely flat places. And you think these unbelievably graceful people wouldn't have any trouble navigating the world. But in reality, it's not the flat space that where they can shine. You know what I mean? And I think it's the same with actors and shyness. I think it's such a safe environment they can risk going to these places.
You don't strike me as a shy man.
You know, I kind of am. I really am a very private person, and I was just in Thailand over the last month where, you know, I'm away from family, I'm away from people who know me, I'm away from people who recognize me, and so I really got to be a fly on the wall, and I really got to be a listener instead of a teller, and I loved that. I loved the anonymity of just getting to hear stories.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Kevin Kling. He's a storyteller, an actor, a poet, and a playwright. His most recent book is called On Stage with Kevin Kling, and he'll be performing in Pella, Iowa, coming up on Saturday, the 22nd of February, with his new show, Breakin' Hearts and Takin' Names. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is storyteller Kevin Kling. His latest book is On Stage with Kevin Kling, and he will be doing an artist in residence at Central College in Pella next week, and that culminates in a performance of his latest show, Breakin' Hearts and Takin' Names, on Saturday the 22nd. You're welcome to join our conversation this hour as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. And Kevin, people who have followed you for years probably know a little bit more about your story. But for people who don't know, you were born with a congenital birth defect. You were born with one arm. Your left arm is significantly smaller than your right and has limited use. When you first started telling stories and getting up on stage, how did you think about your physical presence and how people would respond to you?
You know, I never did. I never it. And luckily, I was brought up by my parents. As much as I tried to use it as my advantage, to my advantage, they never let me get away with anything. And so I was brought up thinking it was just part of me. And I think when you're born with what we call a disability, you're born with something, it's just who you are. You don't even think about it. I had a friend adopting a child from Russia, and he didn't have any hands. And I said, and they were worried, and I said, well, was he born without hands? And she said, yes. And I go, don't even worry about it. He's going to be fine. And because that's the way we perceive the world. So getting up on stage just felt natural to me. And because of that, I don't think it really drew focus, and because it's never been an issue. But 12 years ago, I was in a motorcycle accident, and I lost the use of my right arm, which used to do everything, and that was really different. Now, when you lose something later in life, that's a whole nother challenge. You end up having to grow toward that person, because you're still not that person that lost it, and you have to grow into that person. Does that make sense?
Well, at that point in your career, you were well established as a storyteller and a playwright and had been performing, and very physical in many of your performances. I mean, one of the wonderful things about this new book is that we get to see pictures of you from many of your different performances, and that really drives that home.
I was very physical. Yeah, so, I was even with a circus for a while here in the States and over in Europe. And a stilt walker and all kinds of stuff.
As you were recovering from that accident, and you do tell about what you experienced when you had that accident and really making the decision to live, although you said that it wasn't quite as a clear-cut a decision as that. But when you were laying in the hospital and coming to terms with the fact that you had almost entirely lost use of your right arm and your left arm had limited use. What was going through your head? What were you thinking about?
You know, the hard part isn't really when you're trying to get through the hospital. The hospital stuff is survival. You know, you're just geared to make it. And so that's not when it's hard. And I often think of the guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with injuries. You kind of think that once you've survived, that then the struggle stops, but in reality, that's when the struggle starts. Because once you leave survival mode and enter this new self, then is when you have to start figuring out your day-to-day stuff, and every day has a new frustration. And I know every day around a corner is going to be a doorknob or a shower handle or something that I'm going to have to navigate. And so it's really interesting. I mean, I remember seeing a bunch of nurses in the hospital looking in the door one time, trying to see how I was going to put my socks on. And so every day has a new challenge, and sometimes it can be frustrating, but a lot of times you get an immense satisfaction out of figuring something out. And so, I say this in one of my stories, is that every day is a mixture of blessings and curses, and a lot of times they're right next to each other. If something's only frustrating, I'm fine with it. When it goes deeper, that's when it becomes a problem.
You've also written that you were afraid you couldn't write anymore.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, mm-hmm. I did suffer brain injury, and that was even a bigger concern than losing my right arm. I have to say, was the thought that I might not be able to create anymore. And luckily, I found that I could. I mean, in the hospital, I started doing some writing. I wrote some poems, and that really, and I wasn't a poet, so whatever happened in my head, I turned from a prose writer to a poet, and which has been really exciting.
You mentioned brain injury. A lot of your performance requires memory. I mean, a lot of memory. For most of us, standing up on stage for 2 hours and telling stories without any reference on paper sounds like a very, very difficult task at the best of times. So were you also afraid that you couldn't be a storyteller?
I was. Yeah, that was a concern. And even now, one of the effects of my brain injury is my ability to memorize has definitely been compromised. I can't memorize like I used to, but I can still tell stories. Whatever it is that allowed me to tell stories was left intact, and I feel really lucky about that. Because a told story really relies on the moment, and because of that, I can rely on skills that my brain still has that are in the moment. How do we shift? Where do we go? What's going on? What do I need to be thinking of ahead and at this very moment at the same time? And all that still is right there, and I'm really happy about that.
Well, and you've also said that when you memorize a story or when you learn a story, you don't memorize the words. How do you remember a story?
Well, you put signposts. One of my favorite, I always wondered how the ancient Greeks used to memorize these giant three-day poems, like the Iliad or the Odyssey, and they could tell them back to back, and they took days to tell. And what they used to do, they had a memory trick where they would, every story was a house, and each chapter was a room, and all they did was walk through the house going room to room, and the story would unfold. And it feels like the memory unfolds in that way as well, is that the way you tell a story isn't by rote. In fact, I really try to stress that in the courses that I teach, is that don't tell us the words, or the words will be what arrives in people's minds. Set the imagery. Set us into the story. Bring us into the story. And you can do that with pace, with vocalization, with facial stuff. I mean, there's all kinds of tools at your disposal to help bring somebody into a story. And what you're trying to do is conjure that image inside their minds. Because even as Shakespeare says at the top of Henry V, in his prologue, he says, you know, this stage just can't be the battlefields of Agincourt. This stage just can't be what you want it to be. It's this wooden O. But in your imaginations, we can bring these things to life, these kings, these queens, all this grandeur. And that's what you're trying to do in a story, is place in people these images. And I know a story works when somebody comes up after a show and doesn't tell me what I said, but what it conjured in their minds. You know, my dad used to say that. Or the best compliment I can get is from a kid that says, you know, you're almost as good as my grandpa. And I'll just be happy as a clam after that.
I'm talking with storyteller Kevin Kling. His most recent book is On Stage with Kevin Kling. How is it different when you tell a true story, a story from your life, as opposed to a fictional story that you've made up?
You know, I try to stick to the truth, because truth is always way more bizarre than anything I can imagine.
Especially and yours, so, it seems.
No, you know what? I always tell people, they go, God, the people say, man, you had such a weird life. I go, okay, start talking. We'll see where we end up in 10 minutes. Everybody's life is full of these. And Midwesterners tend to, like, compress our eccentricities, but I tell you, we got it over anybody. I can tell you, one of my favorite stories are our regional stories. And the thing is that we all have eccentric lives. We all have eccentric selves and relatives. And I can just tell about one of my uncles, and after a show, you can just bet somebody will come up and go, you know, here's what my uncle used to do. And we'll just end up laughing our heads off.
Well, I would love it if you would read for us, not a laugh your head off moment, a little bit from the poems that did come out of your hospital stay after your accident. That's where the work Bird Opera came from. And how did this imagery of these birds, and specifically of crows, come to you when you were in the hospital?
Well, on the crows especially, this was the first poem I wrote, and it caught me off guard, because I started just writing, and these poems wanted to be about birds, and I don't even know why. And the first one wanted to be about crows, and I went, okay. And I was kind of worried, because I know crows are, like, in mythology, harbingers of doom, you know, or messengers to the underworld. They have all these things and surrounding them that kind of made me a little bit worried. But I had a buddy visiting me, and he said, no, you don't understand. Crows take away the things we don't want. So the next time you think of a crow, load it up with your fears and send it away. And I started doing that, and he was right. It was like crows do, they take away the things we don't want. And so they, it, now I really like them. Now when I see a crow, I load it up with stuff.
Could you read us your poem about crows?
Yeah, here's the one that came out. It goes, crow, son of a crow, on the crime scene in the know, all dressed up in graveyard black, fingerprints behind his back. He's a crow. He's a son of a crow. Crow, fly away from here. Fly away, my fear. Crow, fly away from here. Fly away, my fear. Two upon the fence, then three to pick the evidence. A flock of cousins take their stations, estimations, accusations. Another sector, another call. One flies off, then two, then all. Over rivers, fields, and cities, administrations and committees. Up and over roads they rise, and off into the gray horizon, afraid to be the last who grows. They're crows, son of crows.
Thank you, Kevin. That's a crow from Bird Opera. Is there another poem from that that you'd like to read to us?
Yeah, there's one about the Canadian geese. Because I really love when they come through and they honk, but there's a mournful quality to them. And some of these poems, they surprised me a bit because almost like, and in fact, in Breaking Hearts and Taking Names, 90% of this stuff, the stories that I tell are humorous and regional. But all of a sudden, through these poems, there started to be heartache come out, and this is one of those poems. And it's Canada Goose, and it goes, he still makes the trip twice a year, past sights once shared by two. The memories make him cry out as each place reminds him of you. He makes the trip twice a year and carries where once held joy the emptiness that sends him to look for love among the decoys. Canada Goose, keep soaring. Keep your song high off the ground. How could emptiness be so heavy? Don't let your heart drag you down.
That is so heartbreaking. And when I was first introduced to you, it was through your humor. And I know that that's how a lot of people come to you, because you make them laugh. And you don't always make us laugh. Do you ever worry about that maybe somebody's come in the door because they want to laugh and you're going to give them something else?
No, in fact, I think that laughter is so close. I think one of the reasons we laugh is to chase away the things we fear. And so that the things, the heart is so close, laugh and a cry are so close together. I always have had the same response from people that come in and they laugh and laugh and laugh, and then there's something that touches their hearts. And they're so grateful for that there's been a chance to feel another emotion in an evening. That it's, to me, a good evening of storytelling is like Cajun cooking. It hits all parts of the tongue. And for me, a good evening of storytelling, you laugh, you think about stuff, you're reminded of things, you get a cry, you get all this, all of it should be in an evening of storytelling on a good evening.
In your book, On Stage with Kevin Kling, there's a transcript of a conversation that you had about storytelling. And one of the beautiful distinctions you draw between storytellers and comedians is you said that stand-up comedians use a joke to close a door, and a storyteller
right.
uses humor or a joke to open the door. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think when it comes to stand-up, you're aiming for a joke. I mean, that's exactly what you're aiming for. You're aiming to make people laugh. But as a storyteller, to end with that would be to waste a great moment, because what you're trying to do in a story is make a small community out of the room. What do we share? What do we all hold together? And when we laugh, all of a sudden we're all together in the same room at the same moment, and we've all shared something. Because laughter isn't universal. Laughter is very specific. And when we all laugh together, we become a family. And to me, that presents an opportunity then to take our family somewhere deeper, somewhere greater. And so as a storyteller, a laugh opens a door, because now you've given me the opportunity to take us a bit further. And that's where, for me, the payoff comes.
Some people call you a humorist, Do you think about yourself that mm-hmm. way?
I do. I love that. I'm always looking because storyteller people generally think of you come and you entertain kids, which is great. But I'm mostly a storyteller for either families or even adults or I think it's a much more less age specific than storyteller kind of indicates, and then a monologuist, and I don't know about that, but I love the term humorist because it's like Mark Twain. If you know Mark Twain's work, I mean, he was funny, but man, he had a bite. I mean, it was incredible what he would use his humor to say about society, what it would say about the world he lived in. And so he's really a mentor for me.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with storyteller, actor, poet, author, playwright Kevin Kling. He's going to be spending next week as an artist in residence at Central College in Pella, and then he'll be performing on Saturday the 22nd, his latest show, Breaking Hearts and Taking Names. We'll talk a little bit about that show when we come back from our break. You're also welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is storyteller Kevin Kling. He'll be doing an artist-in-residence program at Central College in Pella next week and then performing at the end of the week on Saturday the 22nd, his latest show, Breaking Hearts and Taking Names. Kevin, do you do artist-in-residence programs very often? Is this something that has become a regular thing for you?
Yeah, there's storytelling festivals all around the country. And usually connected with evenings of stories, there'll be workshops during the day. And I taught at the university up here in Minnesota for a little bit. And I really love it because then it gives me a chance to hear stories. And I'm always wondering, what is technology doing to the next generation of storytellers? And every time I do one of these workshops, I go away and just high as a kite. I'm just so excited about that storytelling is still just as strong and alive as ever. I mean, the next generation has just taken the torch and running. I'm loving it. I love the new forms. I love some of the poetry slams. I love some of the new forms of storytelling that these guys are creating. I can't do it. It's not my generation, but I love how people are running with the spoken word.
It does seem like a time when we seem to have a little greater appreciation for it. I mean, the Moth Radio Hour and the Moth performances and the Moth Story Slams have gotten to be very popular as well.
They're incredible. Yep. I'm just loving it. I'm loving what's happening with the field and how it's connecting people.
Now, we talked earlier about what I perceive as the vulnerability of being a storyteller up on stage. It seems like with students, that would be, for some students, a very difficult, vulnerable thing to do, to stand up and tell a true story on stage. Is that something you encounter with a lot of students?
It is, but it's again, a lot of that is because they don't, it's do you trust this or not? And the easy way to do it is to the first time you need to tell a story is around people that you trust, is around a safe environment, and so that you get to hear it. And once you hear it, you start to realize what works and what doesn't work. We have a saying in the storytelling field is that it takes 10,000 tellings, which is probably true. Before you get to a story, I mean, you look at the Odyssey, Homer wrote it down, took 800 years of telling before it got to what he wrote. And so it does take a bit of telling, and it's never as scary as it is the first time you tell it. So you can't just get up in front of an audience and tell a story, and of course it would be frightening, but if it started out in a safe environment around people you trust, people that are going to give you not advice that, how they would write it, but ask you questions about it, like how to make it stronger. There's ways to get there that make it a lot easier.
When someone goes through this process, I mean, not everybody is going to become a storyteller. What is valuable about this process? If this isn't, you're not preparing yourself necessarily for a career, it's not really a means to an end. What can I take away from that process if I'm a student?
Well, everybody. I would say that everybody at some point in their life is going to need to get up in front of people or tell a story. Or I love Jerry Seinfeld once. In one of the Seinfelds, he said, at a funeral, people sometimes would rather be the guest of honor than do the eulogy. And it's like, it's true, is people are so terrified about getting up in front of people or telling a story or doing something. And so, especially in this workshop, or with these techniques, it gives you the ability to get up and tell a story, whether it's in front of your family, whether it's in front of your church, whether it's in front of, a speech that you have to give at a certain time. There's just ways to make it all a lot easier, and we all are going to have to do that sooner or later in our lives. And so, and just besides that, just understanding a spoken word, understanding how it works. And so the next time you hear something, or the next time you go to something, or the next time you read something, to have kind of a critical eye on it. Like, I love being in an audience. I would just as soon be in an audience as telling a story, because I love what I learn. I love what is revealed.
When you're working with students, of course, these stories aren't necessarily going to be polished. They're not going to have been told 10,000 times. What is your favorite thing to see when you see a young person telling a story? Is there some sort of transformation that makes you feel like you've really won the lottery?
Well, every time. I mean, when someone realizes that they are a storyteller, and I mean people that don't expect to know that they are, people that are surprised by the fact they can tell a story. And in every class, you already have the hams, and I love those guys too. The folks that really already know they've got it, and they kind of launch into it, and that's always really fun. But then you'll run into somebody that innocently tells a story and all of a sudden looks around, and everyone's looking with wide eyes and open mouth, and they think, oh, man, I can do this. I can tell a story. And that happens a lot. That, in fact, pretty much every time there's a few people that realized they've got the gift.
The show that you'll be performing in Pella is your latest show, but it's not brand new. You've been doing this for a number of years. What's the concept behind Breaking Hearts and Taking Names?
Well, around this time of year, especially being around Valentine's Day, this is a lot of stories that are around the idea of love, and that can be families, dogs, people, and so it's all these different love stories, and it's kind of easy for me because I firmly believe that every good story is a love story. That somewhere in a story you can find any good story. There's love feeds the story. That's just for me. It's the line, and so these are like some of my favorite love stories that I've told. I can't wait. It's my favorite group of stories.
And you tell it along with a collaborator, an accordion player, and Simone Parent.
Simone. She's a beautiful, wonderful singer. And in this case, Simone, I don't think is going to be making this trip. But this is just going to be the story end of it. She has performed. In fact, we perform quite often together when we do different theaters around the country. But I also perform this as a solo piece.
You have done a lot of musical collaborations. You're a musician yourself. You sort of downplay that part of of what you've done over the years. But what is natural about that pairing of music and storytelling for you?
Oh, this is, I got to say, you're really asking some great questions. I'm kind of, you never know going into interviews what you're going to get asked, and you're really nailing them.
Well, thank you.
You're really hitting them. Because this is a, I love using music in storytelling, because even the ancient tellers, the tellers that used to tell a Beowulf, or even, you know, going back, I use the Odyssey as an example, music was really integral to the pieces. And as time has gone on, when you're telling an evening of stories, music re-engages the ear. It gives you a new way of listening. It opens up a whole new way, a new part of your brain for listening. So when you use music in between stories, it can really work as a way to re-engage the audience into the stories, or to bring in music really works on an emotional level. One of my favorite things about musical theater, they say you can always tell when you need a song, because a character will get to a point when all they can do is sing. And you feel that way sometimes in a story, where you hit a point where you just, the emotion is right there at the door, and nothing lets out emotion like a song. And so you put a song there, and it really does top off a story in a nice way.
We only have a few minutes left. Do you have a little love story you could tell us?
Yeah, this is this might end up in Breaking Hearts, and it's when you brought up, in fact, in the break there, I heard a wonderful commercial that was talking about the guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with the post-traumatic stress, which I have as well. And I had this wonderful therapist that had me walk through the accident, and instead of hitting the car, I missed the car. And it did this amazing thing. It by rewriting this story, by recreating this myth inside my mind, I slept better, my anger issues dissipated. It really was an amazing thing, and all we did was rewrite the story, rewrite the way I saw things. And it reminded me of the heart, of the heart is an instrument once broken, never plays the same. But even though it can't be cured, it can be healed, and we move on with another heart. And Michael Hollis from Texas says, a relationship takes patience, luck, and grace. And my favorite word in that group is the grace, because real grace isn't a touch with the divine. Real grace is finding the divine in the everyday. And I look for those moments, especially in love. And I want to move to a story about my grandmother. When I think of moments of grace, I was at my brother's wedding, and a band was playing. I looked over at my grandmother, and I could tell she wanted to dance. Oh, and I'm a terrible dancer. And so I got up with my grandmother. We started to dance, and I was doing a terrible job. And then I remembered something my Uncle Johnny taught me. He said, Kev, if you're ever having trouble dancing, just cinch him in, you know, take him and just pull him in, cinch him in. So I cinched Grandma in, and we started to dance, and I was dancing for the first time in my life, and I was like, man, I'm caught in a rug. And so I wanted to look down and get a look in her eye, like, hey, Grandma, we're dancing. And I looked down, and her eyes were closed, and she was smiling. And, you know, I don't know who she was dancing with, but it sure wasn't me.
That's such a great story. Yeah. Kevin, you have done so much. You've told so many stories. You've written so many plays. You've performed in so many different kinds of performances, invented a few different kinds of performances over the years. You've also published two children's books, one that I think you wrote specifically for my kids with Big Little Mother. And
oh, great.
What is next for you? What are your goals?
Well, I just got back from Thailand, and I've been working with theater companies of performers with disabilities, and now this is the third or fourth country I've gone to work with a new company, and it really has taken my heart. It is the most satisfying work, and at the same time, I was able to spend some time in the foothills with different Hmong communities, and back in the 70s and 80s, a lot of folks from Laos and Thailand and came over, and so there's this great Hmong population in Minneapolis. And I've always been, you know, it's the new Minnesotans, and I wanted to go and see where their home is, like I would going back to my own home. And there was some amazing crossover, and I heard some incredible stories. And so I think that's part of where I'm headed next, is how in this global, how the globe is now turned into this small thing, how we're, you know, so close to each other now, how we're connected, how our stories connect us.
In your book, On Stage with Kevin Kling, when you're talking this transcript, a conversation about storytelling, you talk about why you've stayed in Minnesota and why it's important to you to be a part of your community. And you said you want to be as essential as a plumber in your community.
Yeah.
Why should a storyteller be as essential as a plumber in any community?
Well, I think the idea of identity is really powerful, the sense of where we come from. My dad always would say, you know, you can go anywhere if you know where you're from. And I think that especially somebody who's gone through an accident, somebody who's gone through a loss of any kind, you really need to fall back. In order to survive, you need to fall back on how we belong, how and where we belong. And sense of community is really powerful in healing. And I think as this world, is the ambiguities of this world seem to be increasing, I think the sense of knowing how we belong, how we fit in this world, is also becoming increasingly important. And so to me, to be part of the community is to be a reminder of who we are and why we're a family as a community. And those are, you know, circles that ripple out just like a rock hitting the water. You know, you've got your family that circles out to your near community, to the community. Like, when I go to Iowa, there's so many things we can talk about that connect us. And as somebody with a disability, I know that compassion and tolerance have a shelf life. But when you recognize somebody, somebody is your family, then when you're helping them, you're really helping yourself. And when we get to that point, it really does make the world a better and stronger place.
You mentioned, of course, having a disability, working with actors with disabilities. Although that never became the focus of your performance, when you meet a child with a disability, when they see you perform, or an adult with a disability, and you make that connection, what do you think you can offer to them?
Well, it's I'm always thrilled when there's someone with a disability in the audience, because I think that when you're on the fringes of any society, when you know that the world wasn't built for you, you're always wondering what are your avenues, what are your chances. And I think when somebody with a disability sees me on stage, it's like the first time I saw somebody with a disability on stage, it presented itself as, I can do that. There's somebody doing what I would love to do. And so if I can be that, if I can be an example of somebody that's doing something that society didn't necessarily say I could do, that there I am on stage, I really... That gives me great, great solace.
Kevin Kling, thank you so much. This hour has been such
you.
A pleasure.
Thanks. It's great to get to talk to you. I hope to meet you when I get down there.
I hope so, too. Kevin Kling is coming to Iowa. He'll be doing an artist-in-residence program at Central College in Pella next week and performing on Saturday the 22nd in Pella, doing his show Breaking Hearts and Taking Names. We've been talking also about his latest book, On Stage with Kevin Kling. Talk of Iowa is produced by Ben Stanton, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.